All right, I'll get the others later, and let me start the topic here. So the first topic, I'm going to get off of the library piece and go into energy sector. Because the Biden administration has got, what, 37 days left in office, something like that? Jeez, I'm telling you right now, January 20th can't get here fast enough. Just listen, is there a way to accelerate the calendar? But the Biden administration is continuing to screw stuff up. And not a little bit. Like, they're doing all they can, right? Like, I don't know if you saw it or not. Like, just on a side note, that Biden issued more pardons last night than any president in their first term in the history of the United States has ever issued. Just slinging them out there, man. Who wants to get out of jail free card? Just slinging them. Just, God, it's gross. Anyway, bottom line is, in the energy sector, the Biden administration continues to hose us. So, I've got a, let me tell you how I'm going to do this. Off the Grid is the name of this dipper, right? And we're going to talk about the grid per se in a few minutes. We're also going to talk about regulatory policy and about why you and I have to pay so much at the gas pump and what does it take and why are some places in the United States so much more expensive and why are we buying foreign oil? Well, it's because of jackwagon stuff like this. I'll start with a story that broke today, and this is part of the impetus for me putting this whole section together. In Alaska, everybody knows about the ANWR. That's the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It's a huge swath of the grounds. It's a protected area under Section 102, and it's rich with oil. I mean, the resources in the ANWR are just mind-boggling. And the Biden administration has been shutting down any effort for oil and gas leases. Now, why are they called leases? Because they're on federally controlled land. Federally managed land can't be sold for this purpose, generally speaking, but they can provide oil and gas leases. Well, Congress has mandated, like, this is congressionally mandated, leasing of Arctic National Wildlife Refuge space. And believe me, y'all, it's not like they go in there and just start tearing up the ground, all right? They have so many regulatory hoops they have to jump through. They have so many environmental burdens they have to make sure that they take care of. And they have to do everything as low impact as possible. But fossil fuel exploration in the ANWR is pretty much being shut down by the Biden administration in the last 5 weeks of the administration. So, story on Fox News, Dateline today. Both of Alaska's U.S. senators, the state's governor, and local officials in the remote communities nearest the North Slope, which is the northern edge of the ANWR, collectively expressed that the Department of the Interior's planned January leasing sale was set up in bad faith. Said the governor of Alaska says the Biden administration in the past 4 years has been brutal on Alaska. They're in the twilight of their term, and they're doubling down on denying Alaska opportunities, denying our people opportunities, and denying America the opportunity to potentially get more oil exploration going into the future. So what are we talking about? Well, basically, the Biden administration is bowing to environmentalists, and they're going, yeah, so about those leases that we are congressionally mandated, we're just not going to follow through on that. This is not going to happen. We're going to go ahead and say that most of the ground is off limits, and you can't do it, and just too bad for your luck. Listen, this is not new, though. They've been fighting this battle, and they've been slow-rolling the decision process. I've got a piece here I also pulled off Fox dated back to March of 2022, 2.5 years almost. In an interview with Fox News Digital following his remarks at CPAC, the same governor, Mike Dunleavy, of Alaska, said a breaking point is indeed imminent for when the United States must stop relying on rival countries. So think about this. You've got a savings account, and it's got money in it. But rather than use your savings account when you were short and had to pay the bills, you decided to go, I don't know, down to the local loan shark and borrow money at 30% interest because that made good sense to you because you didn't want to use your savings. Does that ring like does that resonate in some way with some of you? That's what we're looking at right now. We have massive resources, and the ANWR is one of them. We have massive resources here in the United States, and no country does more in the world to preserve our natural resources and to care for and steward our natural resources than the United States. No, show me one. So the end result of this, though, is rather than use our natural resources, we choose to go to places like, oh, I don't know, Iran and Venezuela to buy our resources. And then you got Russia. that's selling to Iran and or purchasing from. You got Russian oil imports. You've got Venezuelan. You've got Iranian. And so the governor said this. He said, we must reverse course and streamline permitting and drop regulations that restrict our oil and natural gas production. The Keystone Pipeline would have replaced Venezuela, Iran, and Russian imports. Biden canceled it on the first day in office. And he's shutting down the leaseholds and that operation in Alaska in his last days in office. So resources, in terms of the oil and natural gas, we are rich. If you think about how big, if you look at the map of the world, the United States has more geography than the vast majority of nations in the world, by far. I mean, China and Russia may have land masses that are somewhat geographically equivalent. But the resources that we have are exponential. And yet the environmentalists keep worming their way into the executive branch and finding ways to shut down the ability for us to actually use what we have. And so we have to go to the loan sharks and borrow money to pay the bills, if you know what I'm saying. But then let's turn from just looking at, oh, by the way, let me do this real quick. Biden also, if you recall, drained our strategic petroleum reserves. Yeah, that makes good sense. Hey, let's tell you what. This is what keeps us safe in case of the attack from a foreign nation or the zombie apocalypse or something. And the Strategic Petroleum Reserve held just 387.2 million barrels of oil as of November 1st, compared to 638 million that were there when Biden took office. But Biden is praising himself and his own administration because they've done a great deal to sort of up it from where it was, which was like down to 180 million barrels. They've been draining it. Why? So they could look good. That's why. Well, we're doing a thing. Well, the thing is not helping us. How about you drill? How about you quit pushing EVs so hard that you're trying to change the grid? All said and done, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve was just being raided by the Biden administration. And now they're bragging on themselves for bringing it back up to, about, 2/3 of what it was when he took office. Just boggles the mind, man. All right, but what about our grid? Do we have enough infrastructure? Do we? And that's a great question. And we're going to talk at the top of the hour with Brad Viator, who probably knows more about this than I ever will. But if you think about just the EV market alone, just the push from the Biden administration, to demand that by the year 2030, we would see, over half of vehicles on the road be electric. Well, they got to get charged somehow. Can our grid even sustain that? And is our grid able to sustain our current needs right now? Is the baseline load able to be met? Do we have enough, high-capacity transmission lines? Do we have enough of what they call the last mile, lower transmission lines? The total amount of electricity all being generated and kept in the queue, Can renewables really sustain that? And is it even feasible to think that we can convert in just a matter of a few years? And what would it cost if we did? And I'll be honest with you, I don't think the answer is one that the environmentalists really want, because what it means is what they're trying to say we can do can't happen. We'll talk with an expert at the top of the hour, but right now we'll take a break. We'll come right back. Y'all, I'm telling you, the electric vehicle boom sounds cool on paper, but all they're doing is gerrymandering our grid and pushing the free market into places where it was never designed to go. Off the grid, that's where we are. We'll be right back. And we are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Solid conservative, just plain right. Making common sense like a superpower. What if I told you that the better mousetrap was being suppressed by the government because they wanted you to have the lesser mousetrap, and they were even going to subsidize the lesser mousetrap with your tax dollars, and you were supposed to buy it. Then they're going to pass laws that said the lesser mousetrap, the least efficient mousetrap, was the one you have to buy. Why? Because they had a notion, they had an agenda, they liked the lesser mousetrap. Well, that's where we are with EVs. But EVs, though, are notional at best. If they can't be charged, what good are they? Do we have the infrastructure? We talked about it multiple times on the show here, but the grid right now We're seeing domestic electricity demand, according to a story I've got here from CNBC last year. Domestic electricity demand in 2022 was expected to increase when they reviewed all the data. They're looking for like an 18% increase. And by 2035, it would be 38% from where we are now. It's seen as being an almost unsustainable increase if the demands that were being called for by the Build a Better Mousetrap people, if the demands that were being called for are put in place. So one guy from a grid strategy group, he said, we got a lot of power demand coming to the country we really didn't have for like the last 25 years. So here's the deal. Think about it this way. It's just like retail stores. If there's a run, oh, I know, here's a good one. If you've got, remember when Beanie Babies were all the craze? Everybody had to have one. Everybody's going to the store looking for the Beanie Babies. They can't find. You're looking at me like you don't know what I'm talking about.
Is that before my time?
It's before your time. All right. That gum. Now I got to. How about what was the Elmo thing that they had for a while?
I was an Elmo kid.
Tickle Me Elmo.
Yes.
Okay. Were you an Elmo kid?
Oh, yeah.
Did you really?
I was a big time Elmo kid. Yeah. Elmo and Sesame Street.
Oh, man. We're getting off on a tangent here now. All right. Tickle Me Elmo, the big, huge Christmas thing. Everybody had, or Cabbage Patch dolls or something. Everybody had to have it. There's a run on the store. Who's got them? Well, you got supply and demand, all right? It's the same with electricity, supply and demand. And if you can't supply the needs because the demand is too high, then you got a problem and the grid has to be built out. But what about if you have more demand than supply? Okay, back it up. What if you have more supply than demand? Well, that's great. Then rates come down. What happens when you have absolute need that can't be met? It creates an inflationary aspect. They have to charge more because they're doing more to build out more to meet up with demand. So what they're saying here is we're going to force demand to increase with EVs and other electrifications in the Green New Deal. We're going to force changes in the grid, but somebody pays for it. It doesn't just happen. It happens through friggin' rate increases. It happens through infrastructure build out. It happens through local taxes. And the consumer winds up paying for it. So they mandate the consumer buy more stuff, in this case, electricity, and then the supply side can't meet it. So the supply side has to raise the rates on the people who were told they had to have it. It's just a jacked up way of doing an economy. What it means, though, is that we have to make major changes to the grid. A story here on CNBC that I told you I was looking at says more high voltage transmission lines to transport electricity. You got to have, if you're going to have rural wind and solar plants, you got to get wire lines out to them, right? Because you got to transmit the power sourcing to the power consumer. Smaller distribution lines and little transformers for last mile electricity, hardware like inverters. And then you got, oh my gosh, holy cow, the number of environmental impact studies. Every county that has new lines run through it has to approve things. Municipalities have to have a play in this. Are there going to be localized or other subsidies that have to be put in place? Is it for a power generation project, or for that matter, is it a consumer, like a new plant being built? Well, everything has to have everybody's buy-in. And so right now, the Biden-Harris administration is closing down portions of our grid, shutting down our ability for energy production. And even this point, I'm looking at a story that I pulled off the Institute for Energy Research. Dateline, last week. The Biden-Harris administration is also halting new coal leases in the Powder River Basin. By the way, the Powder River Basin in Wyoming is one of the largest sourcing of what they call sub-bituminous coal, which is like low sulfur content. It doesn't make as much pollution. The region is responsible for supplying 40% of the nation's coal. 40%. And they just shut down new coal leases on the way out the door. This is unbelievable.
Reckless.
It is. Our energy generation, our grid, our capability of being energy independent. January 20th can't get here fast enough. Coming up, we'll talk to a guy who knows more about it than me, Brad Viator from B Strategies. Y'all stay tuned. We will be right back. Alabama's syndicated news talk leader, Right Side Radio, Phil Williams here live in the Right Side Studios. Man, we got the local, the state, the national, sometimes the international. And oh, yeah, like the dude just said, solid, conservative, and just plain right. Well, welcome to hour number two here on a Turbo Thursday, getting you all the way to Friday. That's the plan. But we're going to bring on a guest right now. So for the last, 20 minutes or so, I've been talking about dipper number one on the show. I call it off the grid. I'm talking about what is happening with our grid, what's happening with our energy supply. How about supply versus demand? Where are we? And can we sustain the policies that are being put out by the Biden administration? And then you got to wonder what's going to happen now that we know that Trump is taking office in just a mere matter of weeks. Well, coming on right now is Brad Viator. He's with a firm called Be Strategic out of Washington, D.C. He founded that in 2022 after spending a long career leading different energy companies and they're advising them on complex legislative, regulatory, media challenges, all the things related to energy. He's a public affairs guy. He spent any number of time in the policy, in the wonkish side of what I would call the regulatory environment. He's also got his Bachelor of Science from Texas A&M. So I guess he's an SEC guy. He's on the phone right now. Brad Viator, how you doing?
I'm fantastic. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for making some time. So, well, let me just ask you up front. Give me the glossy version first. What are your expectations in terms of the change in the regulatory and the policy environment between Biden to Trump that you see coming right now?
I think that, and this is something that I was having a discussion with a friend earlier today who was a political appointee in the Trump administration the last time. I was like, I think everybody in Washington has it wrong right now. They expect that we're going to get back to just sort of regular status quo. A guy is coming into office that we know and understand. A lot of these policies like the IRA and IIJA, two policies that were big energy policy priorities for the Biden administration, are going to be retained because Republicans are benefiting from these policies. And frankly, I think they're wrong. I think we've seen Donald Trump come in and mess things up. He is going to ensure that the status quo is changed, and he's going to offer a disruptive viewpoint. So I think we need to buckle up and get ready for a heck of a ride.
So when you say disruptive, you talking disruptive in a good sense, like taking all this stuff, throwing it out and doing it a different way? Or are you talking about disruptive like this could be painful?
Oh, both. Definitely both. I think that the plan will be disruption for good, but I think some babies will be thrown out with the bathwater. In every sort of scenario, right, like the bad things are what get the headlines, but there are some good things that are buried beneath them. I think it'll be directionally an improvement and kind of a disruption of the status quo and the way things work in Washington, which is largely good. But I think there will definitely be some hiccups along the way.
All right. So you say largely good. Let me ask you. So for the last 4 years, we have seen, in terms of the energy sector, in terms of, supply side, we've seen a difference in the way things have been done in the past. You know, we've had the Keystone Pipeline was stopped. We had, while we hear that drilling is up, it's still not where it could be. And so we've more than one occasion drained the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, that kind of thing. Do you see us getting more into domestic energy production? Before we even get to the grid, how about domestic energy? Are we going to see that increase?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think you saw that in the interview, one of the interviews I saw the president do, I think it was on NBC, or I'm sorry, president-elect, former president, do on NBC or ABC over the weekend, the first sort of real televised interview talking about some of these policy issues. And he said, we're going to drill, baby, drill. And I don't have any reason to believe that that's not going to be the case. I think they're going to be spending a fair amount of time at the beginning trying to think about how they can get those leases solved for. They're also going to be thinking about, what to do with the natural gas distribution system in this country. There is a lot of demand on that system, and this gets into the electricity side of the ledger. There's a lot of demand for new natural gas generation, and that requires natural gas pipelines to get the fuel supply to where those plants are. And I think that's what we're going to see.
So is our let's talk about the grid then. You just mentioned it, the natural gas. You got the of course the electrical generation, but then you've also got the transmission lines, high capacity or low capacity, the last mile to the houses. Do we have a grid that is A, sustainable, and B, meets current needs, or are we already lacking anything in that regard?
Look, it depends on where you are. Depends on where you live. Energy for forever has been a regional issue. It comes down to, you know, what sort of energy supply you have in your region and what sort of energy transmission and distribution and delivery you have in your region. There are very much haves and have-nots when it comes to the energy grid. There are parts of the country that are very well equipped for growth. And there are parts of the country that can't handle, you know, one more kilowatt of demand. And it really is a patchwork quilt and a regional story. I'll tell you, since you're broadcasting from the Southeast is ready. The Southeast has a very stable energy grid that has been making investments in the systems for generations and generations. They haven't turned their back on coal. They haven't turned their back on natural gas. They've built the only two new nuclear plants in this country in the last 40 years. So they're making investments in infrastructure. Some other jurisdictions are not. I'm a Texan, and yes, I'm, I guess, an SEC fan. Been there for 12, 13 years. We can't figure out how to win the big game, but we're definitely a part of the mix. And my home state of Texas is a mess.
Yeah.
Like, what they've got, they are not prepared for any growth. We saw that after Winter Storm Uri. California is a similar problem. They're, you know, Gavin Newsom's getting on the phone and saying, hey, if you wouldn't mind turning your thermostats up to 85 degrees so we can get through the night, that'd be fantastic. You know, that's what they have to do. New England's a similar problem. But there are big sort of industrial regions of the country that are pretty well equipped, from the Southeast, the sort of Southwest, the Pacific Northwest even. Big chunks of the Midwest are in a good place. But the Northeast, really down to D.C., California and Texas are in a whole world of hurt.
So let me ask you though, in that regard, with the for instance, people talk about, they call them renewables, when they talk about adding wind or solar to the portfolio for an energy sector, you know, provider, when they talk about doing this, you still have to have the transmission lines to get into the grid with those systems. So everything has to be built. It's not like it just you put the solar panels out and start generating electricity. But that being said, they don't seem to sustain the same way coal and gas fired plants do, or even hydro for that matter do, and much less nuclear. So are we going to wind up seeing a greater emphasis on all of the above, or are we going to wind up seeing under the Trump administration a pulling back from the wind and solar?
Yep. So let me answer that question. And then you said a bunch of other things that I want to talk about too, if you'll indulge me.
Yeah. We got about 3 minutes to the break.
Yeah, there we go. All right, so a couple things we'll say. Number one, do I think there will continue to be the same size incentives for all those renewables? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Do I think we will be focusing, the Trump administration will be focusing attention on encouraging the development of fossil and other dispatchable resources to include things like nuclear? Yes. Do I think the proliferation of renewables will continue? Also yes, even without subsidy, because as a practical matter, they are cheaper to build, and they have shorter permitting timelines. So I suspect that there will continue to be a proliferation on that front. You said something, though, that is interesting, and I've been doing a fair amount of research on this lately, which is the sort of development and deployment of excess renewable energy actually makes the grid itself less stable and more reliable upon natural gas. The reason being, whenever you have a renewable resource like a solar resource, sometimes a cloud comes over the house. Sometimes it's nighttime, and that solar resource cannot provide the power that's necessary. The utility has to have other resources available to supply all those customers when the solar doesn't show up. So what that means is for all the sort of renewables that are out there, you have to match that supply with dispatchable resources. And where you have these places that have a huge proliferation of renewables, that just means you have to have more dispatchable to match that demand. And, you know, we're sort of at this point where some states have built more renewables than they need to support their existing supply.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So you're paying for electricity that you don't need.
And I guess you guys saw that in Texas just a couple of years ago in that massive freeze when you had wind, the towers, the fans were just basically freezing up and they couldn't even be used.
Yep, that was true. You also had natural gas wellheads that froze up, and gas supplies couldn't move either. So if the wind were to show up and then drop offline, there wasn't the gas to backfill it. I mean, it's a whole mess over there in Texas.
Well, listen, we got to take a break right now. Brad, can you hang on during the break? We'll come back and spend a few more minutes. I want to talk about the sustainability of our grid and whether or not our grid is safe. You got a few more minutes?
Absolutely.
All right. We're on with Brad Viator, who is with Be Strategic out of D.C. He's an expert in basically the regulatory and legislative environment for energy. We'll talk to him more when we get back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Y'all stay tuned. We will be right back. And we are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Solid, conservative, and just plain right. Just, I mean, like, man, saving the world one soundbite at a time. All right, we're going right back now for a few more minutes with our guest, Brad Viator from Be Strategic out of D.C. He's an advisor on legislative and regulatory matters related to the energy sector. And hey, Brad, so we were talking a while ago, and you gave us a lot of thoughts about where things are headed, where they've been. But let me ask you this, in terms of our grid overall, you said the Southeast is fairly prepared. I mean, that's Southern Company and TVA down here, generally speaking, among all the rural co-ops that generate too. But as we look in the big picture, how is our national grid? I know you said it's mostly regional, but how is our national grid in terms of being secure, being, you know, able to be sustained in the event of a natural disaster, that or for that matter, a bad actor from afar?
You know, the question that you're asking, the word we talk about in the industry is resilience, right? Like how resilient is this energy grid? And again, it's a patchwork quilt. Like the places that have been making investment in the grid are able to respond to disaster and recover relatively quickly. I'll give you a great example of Florida. 15 years ago or so, Florida, in the wake of just being pummeled by hurricanes, went in and made a bunch of new investment in things like concrete poles so that when power lines fall down, they're able to go back and restring and rebuild the system, and the outages are a heck of a lot shorter. So it's again a patchwork quilt, and there's a little bit of luck involved in it when you're talking about things like natural disaster. Like in the Southeast, we face a lot of really bad weather, and so we do deal with some outages as a result of things like hurricanes. Other parts of the country, like in California, they have a bunch of risk in and around wildfire that's been pretty well documented lately, and they have a system that they hadn't been making a bunch of investment in. Similar situation up in New England as well. They have a system that they haven't been making a bunch of investments in, so when they have outages, those outages tend to last longer. And, you know, it's a regional issue. Like if you're in a place that has been making investments into the electric system, it's going to be more prepared. If you're in one where you've just let that resource go fallow because you think that, you know, coal production or natural gas production or electricity and industrialization is a bad thing, those resources are less prepared for what's coming.
Yeah. So let me ask then about, you mentioned resilience, and that's the ability to bounce back, I guess. But what about the ability to resist in general? Is our grid secure from bad actors? You know, you talk about hackers. We talk about people that, you know, that would in some way try to sabotage. I mean, how capable are we of defending our grid before the need for resilience even arises?
Yeah, you know, it's a pretty reliable system. 99.999% reliability is sort of where we're operating. 99.98 maybe is the number. It's a very high reliability factor. We're in a pretty good place when it comes to that. I mean, as a practical matter, we haven't seen widespread sort of outage caused by a cyber attack. There was that big outage back in 2003 that people talk about up in the PJM region, caused by a squirrel, among other things. but really, since that's happened, we've largely kept the grid up. You know, there have been a couple of vigilante attacks that we've seen that have had an impact on the grid. We saw that one over in North Carolina, and then we saw about 10 years ago the Metcalf incident up in Northern California with, you know, vigilantes with high-powered rifles who knew what to shoot at take parts of the system down. But as a practical matter, we've avoided it. I think the challenge is these nation-state actors that are organizing some of these attacks are getting better at it, and we've got to figure out how to stay a step ahead of them. And it only takes, you know, one bad one to have a real impact. But under this point, the evidence that I'm seeing is that we've done a pretty good job of mitigating that risk, but it's something that we got to stay on top of.
Well, Brad, listen, we're up against it, man, and I appreciate you spending almost a full half hour with us. And listen, Brad Viator, be strategic. I'd like to keep you on speed dial, and as the Trump administration comes in and things change, maybe have you as a resource to come back on and explain where we are, okay?
Would love to do it. Thanks so much for having me, Phil.
All right, thanks, Brad. Appreciate you. Well, listen, I just think this is pretty amazing, and it's interesting what he said too. When you get down to it, that Trump administration is going to come in, and there are some who believe it's going to be painful, and some who believe it's going to go smoothly, and that he's going to break stuff. But I think that's what we wanted. We wanted somebody to come in and say, and he said it himself. Brad did, get rid of the status quo. I think that's what's about to happen. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, coming up next. Butters and Lee.